Southwest Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. President Obama will be visiting Cuba next month, and Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes says that Mr. Obama's decision to go to Cuba was his.
President's judgment was that, number one, going to Cuba was an important step forward in signaling this new beginning between our two countries and peoples, and also importantly that going to Cuba could help enlarge this space that benefits the Cuban people and increases ties between our countries.
The trip had long been expected as part of Mr. Obama's efforts to make as much progress as possible in improving ties with Cuba before he leaves office in January of next year. Cuban officials welcomed the upcoming visit and expressed a willingness to discuss any issues. Pope Francis, who has spent the last week in Mexico, injected himself into the U.S. presidential race on Thursday, suggesting that Republican frontrunner Donald Trump is not a Christian because of his proposal to build a massive wall on the southern U.S. border with Mexico to keep out migrants. Trump, a Presbyterian, said at a campaign rally in the Atlantic coastal state of South Carolina that the pontiff's comments were not a nice thing to say. He said the Pope questioned his faith is disgraceful. The comments, 2 days ahead of the presidential primary in the state of South Carolina, where Trump has a lead over five Republican challengers. Police in Uganda briefly arrested presidential candidate Kizza Besigye after he tried to enter a house he said was being used for rigging the national elections. Vote counting has begun after millions of voters cast ballots Thursday for president, parliament, and local government seats. This is VOA News. U.S. and Russia will launch an effort today that could bring long-term stability to efforts to get humanitarian aid to besieged areas of Syria. The two countries, under the auspices of the United Nations, co-chair an initial meeting of a ceasefire task force in Geneva. The task force will explore prospects for a long-range cessation in Syria, where a five-year war has resulted in the deaths of more than 400,000 and displaced millions more. Meantime, a senior humanitarian official says that the World Food Program is organizing emergency airdrops of desperately needed foods to thousands of Syrians trapped in the eastern part of the country, which is under siege by the Islamic State militants. We get more now from Lisa Schlein at the UN in Geneva.
The Task Force on Humanitarian Access on Syria met to take stock of the progress made in delivering aid to inaccessible regions of Syria since last week. Special Advisor to the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Jan Egelen, reports 114 big trucks succeeded in the past 24 hours in delivering life-saving humanitarian supplies to 80,000 people in five of Syria's 18 besieged areas. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
Turkey has blamed the car bombing that killed 28 people in Ankara on a Syrian man with links to Kurdish militia groups, but the United States says it is yet to determine who launched the attack. Car bomb was detonated just a few hundred meters from Turkey's parliament and military headquarters, no one so far claiming responsibility. The most senior European Union leaders have expressed confidence and interest in Britain remaining a member of the grouping. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker spoke ahead of a two-day summit in Brussels, saying he's confident and convinced that Britain will be a constructive and active member of the EU. Prime Minister David Cameron says he's determined to do what's right for Britain at the Brussels summit.
I'll be battling for Britain. If we can get a good deal, I'll take that deal, but I will not take a deal that doesn't meet what we need. I think it's much more important to get this right than to do anything in a rush.
Cameron wants concessions from other EU leaders on key demands that he can present to British voters and a referendum on whether the country should remain a part of the EU. Here in Washington, the White House saying that President Obama has started the process to replace the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Most Republicans, including the majority leader of the Senate, says that the next president should be chosen, be the one to choose Scalia's replacement.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Friday, February 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. As Ugandans await results of Thursday's election, main opposition candidate Kizza Besigye explains his standoff with police on polling day.
We have very reliable information, in fact, corroborated information that a certain residential house in a suburb of Kampala called Naguru was being used as the hub for rigging the elections.
Kizza Besigye is the presidential candidate of Uganda's main opposition Forum for Democratic Change. Jill Craig will wrap up the rest of yesterday's voting process in Uganda. Doctors Without Borders says at least 16 people were killed at a civilian protection site in Malakal, South Sudan. And South Sudan's president urges his first vice president to come to Juba to form a unity government.
Formation of the government of national unity is overdue. So that's why the president saw it appropriate for him to give 7 days to Dr. Riek Machar to come to Juba so that they can form the transitional government, you know, together.
Aten Work Aten is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir, and Ivory Coast soldiers get life sentences for killing a former junta leader. Those stories, plus Mark Omar's sports now, World Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's Electoral Commission yesterday extended the deadline for voting across most of Kampala and some districts in the capital by 3 hours yesterday due to late arrival of voting materials. Meanwhile, main opposition candidate Kizza Besigye says the country's electoral process is inherently unfree and unfair, but he said he and his supporters will continue to challenge the system. He explains to me why he and his supporters stormed a residential building in Nanguru yesterday.
We have very reliable information, in fact, corroborated information, that a certain residential house in a suburb of Kampala called Nanguru was being used as the hub for rigging the elections. That's where they were picking the ballot papers and distributing them to the rest of the country. That is where there is the ICT center, where the results relayed from the districts actually first come, and then it's that center that relays to the Electoral Commission. All of it, of course, illegal. So we went to that building, having reported also to the police, as a formality that there is a crime being perpetuated there. We went to the building, and indeed it's inhabited by a unit of the police called the Police Crime Intelligence Unit. This is a new unit that is now headed by a military officer that was appointed sometime last year, a military officer called Lieutenant Colonel Dahura.
I was speaking to the Minister of Information, Mr. Muwezi, who said that you and your supporters were trespassing on a private property.
Well, we are not trespassing. First of all, as I told you, we informed the police about this. Secondly, we went and knocked at the door. We are not allowed in, as a matter of fact. We knocked at the door and indeed found that once they opened the slide, they opened the door, that we saw many police officers there. And the officer who arrested me informed me that it is inhabited by that unit, the unit led by Lieutenant Colonel Dahura, an officer who was part of the Presidential Protection Unit and committed many electoral offenses in the 2001 elections, featured prominently in court processes thereafter.
Given what has transpired, the campaigning where some of your supporters or you were prevented from having, I think, a rally in Kampala, do you think the process, if and when the results finally come out, I know it's too early to say, would you say the process was free and fair?
The electoral process in Uganda is inherently unfree and unfair. In fact, calling it an election is in certain ways a misnomer. But as I have again pointed out, this is a process that we seek to defiantly overwhelm its huge biasness and overturn the dictatorship. And that's what we've been working on. That's what we are going to continue working on, regardless of whether they declare themselves as winners or not. They have no legitimacy whatsoever. they have never had, even from previous elections. So we wait and see how this process ends, but the election in this country is inherently not free or fair.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is the presidential candidate of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Ugandans turned out in large numbers to vote in presidential and parliamentary elections Thursday, despite delays in parts of the country like Kampala and Wakiso. The Electoral Commission extended polling hours from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. for voters in those districts. Virgil Craig has more from Kampala.
Polling stations in Uganda were scheduled to open at 7 a.m. Thursday, but some voters waited up to 5 hours before ballot papers arrived. Makerere University student Christopher Ntega was one of the voters who came at 7 a.m. but could only wait in line.
Right now I kept my time to come and vote, but I don't see any voting material, nor any voting assistance. Nothing is here yet, apart from the observers.
Uganda's Electoral Commission said polling started on time in various parts of the country, but acknowledged late openings in parts of Wakiso and Kampala and stated it regretted the delay. According to a statement from the Citizens Election Observers Network Uganda, 41% of polling stations countrywide opened after 8 a.m. 4% had not opened as of 8:30 a.m. Kampala voter Carolyn Humble waited 4 hours at the Kamocha Park Yard polling station to vote, but says she was pleased with the process overall.
It's very organized, yeah. Everything is okay.
Some, like attorney Anthony Wameli, said they would stay in line all day if that is how long it took to vote for their candidate.
If we can choose a president beginning today, we have never done that before. You know, all the presidents of Uganda have come in through the gun, but we have a chance now, and I think if that can be true, then I'll be glad.
Some voters said they are pleased with the current president and are voting for him to stay in power.
I voted for President Museveni because we have the peace that we're enjoying because of him.
At the Gaba Road polling station in Kampala, voters waited at least 7 hours for ballot papers, which turned out to only be for members of parliament, not for president. They grabbed the ballot boxes and threw them on the ground, which resulted in police firing tear gas. Election workers left the polling station, making it unlikely that voting will continue there. By mid-morning, voters noticed that social media sites like Twitter, Facebook, and WhatsApp were slow or not working. The head of the Uganda Communications Commission, Godfrey Mutabazi, said the sites had been blocked for security reasons. Incumbent President Yoweri Museveni faces competition from 7 other candidates vying for Uganda's top job, most notably main opposition leader Kizza Besigye, who has lost to Museveni 3 times before amid controversy. More than 15 million people are registered to vote in the presidential and parliamentary elections. Jill Craig, VOA News, Kampala.
A spokesman for South Sudan's president says the president is considering waiting to name a new transitional unity government until his political rival, Riek Machar, takes up his post as first vice president. South Sudan President Salva Kiir had given Riek Machar until early Friday morning to take up his position as part of a peace accord that the two signed to end months of civil war. Riek Machar had said he would only return to Juba after the city is demilitarized, as stipulated in the agreement. Presidential spokesman Atene tells reporter Peter Clotty that the president could wait to name a new transitional unity government in the interest of peace.
He actually issued 7 days urging Dr. Riek Machar to come to Juba so that he can form the transitional government of national unity. And the 7 days are running out midnight. Otherwise, it will still remain the prerogative of the president to see the next course of action. And he's the one to provide the way forward. So it is up to him whether he will dissolve the government and form the government, or he is still given another time to wait for Riek Machar to come, as it was required by the agreement.
Dr. Riek Machar says he is unlikely to be there until the capital is demilitarized, as stipulated in the agreement both of them signed. So on Friday, it doesn't look like he will be there when the ultimatum elapses. So what's next?
The Juba is likely to be demilitarized in the next few days, but otherwise, formation of the government of national unity is overdue. The IGAD and the IGAD partners, plus the friend of South Sudan, has been hanging President Salva Kiir to form the government. And that whenever there is a blame, then the two sides are blamed that they are failing or dragging their feet in formation of the government of national unity. So that's why the president saw it appropriate for him to give 7 days to Dr. Riek Machar to come to Juba so that they can form the transitional government, you know, together.
Dr. Riek Machar
has
announced that he is not coming to Juba until the area is demilitarized according to the agreement. Now, so how do you address these concerns that he has?
Both Machar and President Salva Kiir have all technical advisors, and the international community advises them, you know, when it is appropriate in the circumstances. So if the president has received some other advice to wait longer, then he will be waiting for Machar and then for the process of the demilitarizing Juba to take place.
Does that mean that tomorrow, Friday, it is unlikely for President Salva Kiir to name his transitional unity government after he issued an ultimatum to Dr. Riek Machar to come? Because there's a stalemate here. How do you move forward with this stalemate?
It's not unlikely. I just want to answer your questions, that it is not unlikely because the president has the prerogative, you know, he can decide to wait further. He can give more time to the Dr. Riek Machar. And he also has right to dissolve the government tonight or tomorrow evening. And, you know, the president is not limited in as far as his powers are concerned constitutionally. So I cannot say it is unlikely. It may be likely. But what I say is that in the interest of peace and the interest of the proper implementation of the agreement, President Salva Kiir might wait, you know, might give further time for Dr. Machar to come to Juba in order for the government of national unity to be complete. This is what the people of South Sudan want. If we are still being blamed, then that's where, you know, the partial government can be formed.
Atene Wekatene is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotte from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 19th. Still to come, Mark Oldman's Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 18 minutes past the hour. A spokesman for Doctors Without Borders says at least 18 people were killed in an armed conflict that erupted yesterday in a civilian protection camp in Malakal, South Sudan. Marcus Bachman is spokesman for Doctors Without Borders.
Since yesterday night, around 11 o'clock p.m., there was an eruption of fighting inside the protection of civilians in Malakal, which led to a larger number of wounded, mainly gunshot wounded. In total, we have received about 73 wounded, the majority of them with gunshot wounds.
Was there fighting among the residents or the people you are protecting, or did somebody attack the people?
What we could observe is that different groups within the protection of civilian sites were engaged in fighting. We are not in a position from our hospital to determine if there was also implications from outside of the PSC. We cannot judge that.
Who is responsible for protecting the camp? South Sudanese forces or United Nations forces?
United Nations forces are in charge of the protection of civilian sites.
Once again, what's the death toll and what are some of the weapons used in the attack?
What we can state from the medical team working in our MSF hospital, the very vast majority of the wounded we have received sustained gunshot wounds. We are now not in a position to determine exactly which type of weapons have been used, but the vast majority of the wounded received sustained gunshot wounds. Of these, 16 have died in the hospital or had arrived dead already before reaching the medical care in our hospital.
If people die from gunshot wounds, how were those weapons able to come into the camp?
I think it's a reality in a country which is at war or civil war that you can find weapons everywhere. It is one of the unfortunate truths that we also have to assume that weapons are inside these IDP camps and the protection of civilian sites.
Do you suspect that perhaps the South Sudan civil war might have spilled over in the camps where there are different groups supporting different sides of the conflict?
A camp is, of course, always representing the realities around a camp. The camp population in Malakal is composed by the three major ethnic groups which are living in this area of Upper Nile State, the capital of which Malakal is. So the tensions you would find outside of the protection of civilian sites very, very much mirrored also inside the POC among the different groups of the IDPs inside the camp.
That was Marcus Bachman, spokesman for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking with me from South Sudan's capital, Juba. 14 years after the murder of Ivory Coast former junta leader and President Robert Guy, three former senior officers close to then-President Laurent Gbagbo were found guilty of murder and complicity of murder by a tribunal court in Abidjan on Thursday and sentenced to life in prison. Emily Yup reports.
19 people stand in the dock of a military court in Abidjan for the past 3 weeks, accused of murder and complicity in murder of former junta leader Robert Guy and his family. Madeleine Koulibaly is the sister of a military officer killed along with Guy. She says she is relieved by the verdict. Justice has been served, Koulibaly said, and thanks to that, I think we will finally be able to find closure. Guy became Ivory Coast leader in 1999 following a military coup before losing to contender Laurent Gbagbo at the presidential elections a year later. Guy's bullet-ridden body was found by a roadside in Abidjan the day of a failed coup against Gbagbo in September 2002, which led to years of crisis in the country. The three men accused in the trial included a former commander of the presidential guard and the head of the bodyguards of Gbagbo's wife. They were found guilty of murder and complicity in murder and sentenced to life in prison. One of the lawyers of the defense, Modeste Ablié, says they intend to appeal the decision.
Je suis déçu mais pas découragé. Au sortir de cette salle, nous allons former pouvoir contre cette décision parce que nous estimons que nos clients ne méritent pas d'être condamnés à vie.
I'm disappointed but not discouraged, he says. As we exit this courtroom, we will appeal the decision because we believe our clients don't deserve a life sentence. The prosecution was unable to give damning evidence against them. Other accused were sentenced to 10 years in prison, while a dozen were acquitted. Emily Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel dismissed their host, the United Arab Emirates national team, 105-73 in the quarterfinal action at the Dubai International Basketball Tournament in Dubai on Thursday. In other quarterfinals, Lebanon's Sagese edged Egypt's Sporting Alexandria 70-65. The United Arab Emirates' Al Ahly outplayed Egypt's Zamalek 85-69. And Tunisia's Club Africains beat US and won 75-68. Today, Friday, in the semifinals, Club Africains plays El Ahly as Etoile du Sahel engage Segasse. In Olympic news, the cities of Budapest in Hungary, Los Angeles in the United States of America, the French capital Paris, and the Italian capital Rome have met the submission deadline for their first documents in their bid to stage the 2024 Olympics. The International Olympic Committee president Thomas Bach confirmed in Lausanne, Switzerland. Turning to athletics, Djibouti's world indoor 1500-meter champion Ayanle Suleiman set a world 1,000-meter record of 2 minutes and 14.20 seconds at the IAAF World Indoor Tour meet in Stockholm, Sweden on Wednesday night. The old mark of 2 minutes and 14.96 seconds was set by Kenyan-born Wilson Kipketer of Denmark 16 years ago. Later at the meet in Stockholm, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba triumphed in the women's 1 mile in a world record of 4 minutes and 13.31 seconds. The old mark of 4 minutes and 17.14 seconds was run by Romanian Doina Melite in 1919. Still in Stockholm, Morocco's Abdelati Igida clocked 7 minutes and 39.04 seconds to win the 3,000 meters in the world's fastest time in the event this year. Ethiopians Yomif Kejelcha and Yeneu Alamireo followed. In football news, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe host Tunisia's Orange African Confederations Cup champions Etoile du Sahel in the Orange African Super Cup Cup in Lubumbashi tomorrow, Saturday. Finally, in cycling, the six-day Africa Road Cycling Championship starts in Casablanca, Morocco on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We see you again on Monday morning.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 19th. On this day in 1942, the Tuskegee Airmen, the black servicemen of the U.S. Air Force, was created at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. During World War II, blacks were not allowed to learn to fly fighter planes because some believed they lacked the intelligence, skills, and patriotism. But a young black student at Howard University sued the U.S. government to begin training black pilots at black schools. And so, a flight school was started at Tuskegee. A squadron of black pilots from there fought in World War II and received honors for their bravery. Also on this day in 1919, the Pan-African Congress, organized by W.E.B. Du Bois, met in Paris. There were 57 delegates, 16 from the United States and 14 from Africa. Blaise Diagne of Senegal was elected president and Du Bois was named secretary. On this day in 2002, Vonetta Flowers became the first black gold medalist in the history of the Winter Olympic Games. She was also the first American woman to win a gold medal in bobsled. Vonetta, the brick person, and her partner Jill Bakken won the gold medal in the 2002 Winter Olympics in Park City, Utah. Also on this day in 1940, soul singer William Smokey Robinson was born in Detroit, Michigan. Robinson's first singing group was the Miracles, which he formed in 1955 while still in high school. On this day in 2010, Tiger Woods, then the world number one golfer, talked publicly for the first time since the scandal surrounding his private life erupted in 2009. During his press meeting, Woods admitted that he had been unfaithful to his wife by having extramarital affairs. On this day in African history, in 2011, Somali pirates took four Americans hostage after hijacking a yacht traveling in the Indian Ocean. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 19th. Congratulations to Abdullahi Mohammed of Kantape District in Abuja, Nigeria, and Adi Kalesuma of Conakry, Guinea. You are the winners of our February 18th question, which African-American scientist invented the wooden churn, a device that made it easier to convert cream into butter? The answer, A.C. Richardson. Now, here is our question for today, February 19th. Who was the first African-American student to enroll at the all-white University of Mississippi in 1962? Once again, who was the first African-American student to enroll at the all-white University of Mississippi in 1962? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com.
Stand up for your right. Get up.
And that's it for this Friday, February 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk. Bullying. Are you intimidated by it? Why does it happen? What is your experience? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing bullying. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Githui-Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day. All night.